Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
Hello, welcome to a new year, a new decade, and a new edition of the Chemistry World Podcast, brought to you this month by Phil Broadwith, Matt Wilkinson and Nina Notman. Coming up, we've got news of a new kind of cellular antifreeze that's been found in a beetle in the Arctic and can protect it to as low as minus 60 degrees C. We'll hear how it works shortly. We'll also be venturing into a world where size really does matter.
We built, as far as we can tell, world's first nanoscale rotary motor, which has a kind of a propeller that can rotate either clockwise or counterclockwise. The energy came from the light. So when we irradiate, the propeller starts to move. And you have to realize this motor was the size of 1 nanometer, 1 billionth of a meter.
Microscopes not provided, but Ben Fieringer will be with us to talk nano later in the program. Also, carbonic acid, the stuff that forms when CO2 dissolves in water, has been under scrutiny this month, and chemists have discovered that it's a lot more acidic than they gave credit for.
Well, it says that it's a lot stronger than your chemistry textbooks at home will have in it. This process is of absolute crucial importance to the carbon cycle. CO2 is stored in massive amounts in the oceans. So if when CO2 dissolves, if it actually is more acidic, the acidification of the oceans is going to be a lot more severe than previously thought.
I wonder what the politicians in Copenhagen made of that. The whole story is coming up courtesy of Matt Wilkinson. Also on the way, we'll be dipping a paintbrush into the art world to hear how scientists are using Raman spectroscopy to probe the origins of ancient works. Hello, I'm Chris Smith. Welcome to Chemistry World.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.
Now, most of us eschew the cold with a vengeance, but, Phil, scientists have uncovered one creature that probably revels in it.
Yes, well, more than one creature, actually, Chris. There's a whole family of beetles and fish and toads that can survive really, really cold temperatures, not just like Cambridge in the snow. We're talking minus 60 in the Arctic, the Antarctic. And the particular one we're interested in today is the Arctic darkling beetle, which can survive down to minus 60 degrees.
Wow, how?
Well, as with a lot of these animals that can survive in very cold conditions, it has a molecule that helps it stop ice growing in and outside its cells.
But this isn't that new, is it? Because we've seen examples of antifreezes in fish, we've had antifreezes in snow fleas from Alaska. Unilever have borrowed antifreeze molecules from bacteria to make smoother ice cream. So how is this different?
Well, all of the antifreeze molecules that have been found in other animals so far have been proteins. What makes this one different is that it's not a protein, it's based on sugars and a lipid. In fact, the team that were looking for it, led by Jack Duman from Notre Dame University in Indiana, were looking for a protein. The poor student, Ken Walters, on this project spent 2 years trying to identify the protein that was responsible for the antifreeze properties. He could get an extract from the beetle that showed antifreeze characteristics, but couldn't find any protein. Eventually, they found this other molecule that was responsible.
So tell us what the molecule is and how they think it contributes to the antifreeze effect.
Okay, so the molecule itself is relatively simple. It's two sugars, a xylose and a mannose, in a little polymer, which they've called xylomannan. And then on the ends of that, there's a lipid. They think that the reason the lipid's there is to bind it into the cell membranes, because the easiest way to stop ice forming is to bind to crystals on the outside of the cells and stop them from growing.
And of course, one has to ask, in any setting like this, what about applications?
Well, now that we know that there is this entirely new class of antifreeze molecules, we can start looking for it in other insects, in other places where antifreeze proteins have been hard to identify. So perhaps other organisms use this kind of molecule instead.
Thank you very much, Phil. Now, Nina, talking of animals and how animals can help to do wonderful things for science, interesting news on mussels, the underwater variety, and how they're trying to muscle in on tissue repair and even diabetes research. Tell us about this.
So a group led by Phil Messersmith at Northwestern University in the US has been taking inspiration from marine mussels and the way that they stick themselves to rocks and boat hulls to make a new type of medical adhesive that works on the wet tissues inside the body. So their glue is based on a branched polyethylene glycol core which has got catechol-like N groups, and it's a catechol group which comes from the marine mussels.
So basically they're stealing the way in which the mussel glues itself onto things. How does this actually get applied inside the body? What actually happens chemically when it wants to stick something together?
So catechol is an aromatic ring with two alcohol groups on it. And when it oxidises, it forms carbonyl groups and it then reacts again. And this is how the polymers cross-link, and that's the solidification process of a glue. And the groups can then react again to form a covalent bond and bond itself to the tissue.
And then what do you do with it?
The application they've been looking at is pancreatic islet transplantation, which is an experimental technique where donor pancreatic cells are implanted into the liver of diabetes sufferers. So once the cells are inside the body, they can make and release insulin, which means that the diabetes sufferers no longer need to inject insulin daily.
So the theory would be you take the cells that you want to put into the diabetic, coat them with this material, which then presumably glues them together, and then you infuse them into the liver. Why is that better than just infusing the cells into the liver?
At the moment, when the cells are infused into the liver, there's some kind of immune response which stops the cells from working 2 to 3 years later. So Phil Messersmith and his group have been looking at different places within the body to infuse the new cells. And so far they've tested sticking the new cells to the liver surface, the pancreas surface, and also to the surface of fat tissues in mice. And they've showed that the cells both stay put and they still work a year later, and that the fat tissue is the best place to stick them.
And the consequence for the mice is that these cells work properly and produce insulin?
They've tested it up to a year so far, and yes, they do.
So, appropriately enough, a sticky treatment for a sugary disease. We'll watch that one with interest. Thank you, Nina. And now to the science of the really, really tiny.
My name is Ben Feringa of the University of Groningen, the Netherlands, and I'm a professor of organic chemistry. Now, this field is about building tiny machines the size of molecules. We are talking about nanometer scale. That's 1 billionth of a meter.
Is size the only major challenge, though?
The size is certainly a challenge, but much more important, of course, is to control the dynamic behavior. When you think of the motor in your car, it's extremely important that there is fuel going in, that it is moving, it makes a rotary motion, otherwise your car would not drive. And what we have to accomplish at the scale of this nanometer size is to design systems, molecules, that do exactly similar kind of things. So we have to fuel them, we have to control the motion, and we have, hopefully, we are able to perform some work with these tiny machines.
What sorts of applications have people got in mind for them, or what sorts of things have they achieved so far?
Yeah, so far, there are not that many applications yet, because this is very early days. We first have to design these things and to find out what are exactly the principles, you know, because you cannot translate from the macro world, say the machines in our factories and in our cars, to this really tiny world of nanoscale and molecules. But to realize what is the potential, in our body, when you go into the cells, there are plenty of machines and motors, and they have exactly the similar kind of function. So to transport molecules, pump something through cell membranes to make it possible that cells can divide, etc. So there are 50 or so different types of motors that have been identified. And so if nature made so heavily use of these tiny motors in living organisms, it is a bit weird that we don't use at this moment any of these kind of motors when we think of nanotechnology or nanoscale designs, etc., or in material science. There must be a whole future there once we are able to use their properties. And this is exactly what we and many other groups are doing now.
I was just going to say, because nature must have solved a lot of your problems for you already, because if you look hard enough in cells, just like you say, you can find beautifully elegant examples of things being done which we dream of in science fiction movies. As you say, these protein motors that move things along nerve cells 75 millimetres a day, which at the kind of scale we're talking about, it's like taking a rocket to the moon, and cells are already doing that.
It is astonishing what nature has accomplished, and these designs are so beautiful. We have designed in our laboratory a tiny motor where we try to mimic the flagella motor of a bacteria. I use this example because this is a fantastic design of a complex protein system that makes it moving forward or backward on command. We try to mimic something like that with much more simpler designs and simpler molecules to see how we can move between two spots and then ultimately to transport something from A to B. And yes, we are astonished by what nature has accomplished in that sense. Once again, our designs are much less elaborate. But we had less time than nature had during evolution, of course.
Indeed, nature's had 4 billion years or so. But taking that a step further, it's an interesting science that you find yourself in, isn't it? Because basically you've got many other solutions. You know that cells and things can do this. They have often got answers to many of the problems we would like to solve. You've got to work out how to actually rebuild what cells have already done.
Absolutely, but you have to realize that many of these ingenious machines that are used in the cells cannot be used outside the cell. As soon as, for instance, this flagella motor of the bacteria, if you take it, these components out of the cell membrane, they simply don't operate in the proper way anymore. So to build some robust systems that we can use, we have to use other molecules, other materials, and redesign them. So there is two big challenges. One is to try to design molecular machines and molecular motors and to find out the basic principles. How does it work? How does it operate? Do we really understand how machines work at that level? And second, can we build useful things with it? Can we use these tiny machines, once we understand how to make them, in a robust setting? For instance, to make a new material, a new drug delivery system, or maybe ultimately a nanorobot or so.
But nature's also given you some of the answers, hasn't it? Because there are wonderful things like protein structures and for instance, DNA sequence,
absolutely,
which acts as a sort of address system. So you can actually use the three-dimensional structures of these things, which are very predictable. There are very good computer programs to do that, to address molecules to particular bits of three-dimensional space. So we're sort of getting there, aren't we? We've got a few ways of doing this.
Absolutely. There is a lot of lessons to be learned from nature. And, of course, DNA is a wonderful material in that respect because it has all this information stored in it. And so many people around the world, including our own group, we use DNA to take advantage of the information that is in the molecule to build new molecules, you know, the so-called hybrid type of structures, where you take parts of nature and parts of synthetic materials and take the best of two worlds.
Now, I know that this year is an important year for you because it's actually 10 years since you did a beautiful piece of work. So I know about it, but for the people who don't, just tell us what it was you did 10 years ago.
Now, what we did is we built, as far as we can tell, world's first nanoscale rotary motor. So we built a molecular system which has a kind of a propeller that can rotate in a unidirectional sense, say either clockwise or counterclockwise. The energy came from the light. So when we irradiate with a lamp source or with sunlight, the propeller starts to move. And you have to realize this motor was the size of 1 nanometer, 1 billionth of a meter. And as far as we can tell, this was the first unidirectional rotary motor that was made. Since then, we have enhanced the speed of this motor. Originally, it was about once an hour or so. That's a very slow motor. But since then, we have been able to redesign these systems, and now we can propel at a rate of several million times per second without compromising the motor function.
Ben Fieringer with what could possibly be the next Christmas must-have. You're listening to Chemistry World with me, Chris Smith. And still to come, scientists break one of the strongest bonds, a new way to chemically interrogate works of art, and a new desire-boosting drug that promises to raise more than just an eyebrow. But before then, have we significantly underestimated the power of carbonic acid, Matt?
Indeed, Chris. Scientists from Germany and Israel have discovered that carbonic acid is actually stronger than previously believed. How they've done this is by actually taking a very, very quick snapshot of the molecule before it has a chance to dissociate.
So talk us through the actual process of what we thought was going on with carbon dioxide when it reacts with water to make carbonic acid and how this new discovery has changed our impression and perception of that.
When CO2 dissolves in water, it forms carbonic acid, and then it rapidly dissociates to the bicarbonate anion. This makes studying the strength of carbonic acid itself very, very difficult, because it can then go on to lose a further proton. So what they did in this case was they put a bicarbonate salt in solution with a photoacid, which is an acid that can be activated by shining light on them. They shone a femtosecond laser at the solution, and then a femtosecond later, they measured the infrared spectrum of the solution to see how long the molecule exists before it disappears.
And how does this inform our understanding of the behaviour of carbonic acid, and what surprises were lurking in there?
Well, it says that it's a lot stronger than your chemistry textbooks at home will have in it, putting it somewhere between acetic and formic acid. But what's crucial is that this process is of absolute crucial importance to not just buffering the pH of blood, it also mediates the carbon cycle. So you've probably heard about the Copenhagen climate summit, and CO2 is stored in massive amounts in the oceans. And so when CO2 dissolves, if it actually is more acidic, the acidification of the oceans is going to be a lot more severe than previously thought.
Indeed. Thank you, Matt. Food for thought. That was Matt Wilkinson reporting on the work of Eric Nibbering, who is a scientist based at the Max Born Institute in Germany. And that work he was describing has been published recently in the journal Science. And you can also read the write-up on the Chemistry World website at chemistryworld.org. Now, from a strong acid to a strong bond, but one which, Phil, scientists say they've found a brand new way to break.
Yes, absolutely, Chris. We're talking about nitrogen and the nitrogen-nitrogen triple bond, and also carbon monoxide and the carbon-oxygen triple bond. So these are two of the strongest bonds that we know in chemistry. And Paul Chirik and his group at Cornell University in the US have found a way to take both of those two molecules, mash up all the atoms again, break both of those two very strong bonds, and make some really useful organic compounds.
Tell us how they're doing it.
Okay, so it all revolves around a hafnium complex. So this is a hafnium ion sandwiched between two cyclopentadienyl rings. It's called a hafnosine. If you take a couple of these complexes, you can trap a dinitrogen molecule in between them. So it's bonding to two hafnium atoms. That gives you essentially a nitrogen-nitrogen single bond now, because two of those bonds are bonding to hafnium. Then you add carbon monoxide. And normally you'd expect carbon monoxide to be a very good ligand for metals, so you'd expect it to bond to the metal. But instead, what these guys have seen, it inserts into that final nitrogen-nitrogen bond, breaks apart the two nitrogen atoms, and you get a compound called oxamide, which is already itself used as a slow-release fertiliser.
So is that where they're going with this? It's an easy way to make fertiliser, or would this be some kind of intermediate compound which is chemically active, which we could then use to turn into other things?
Well, oxamide itself can be converted into various other organonitrogen compounds, and also if you use different amounts of carbon monoxide, you can break open the nitrogen bond in different ways to make different compounds, which are again useful to make all sorts of different things.
And this process, presumably, once you've got this reaction occurring and you've got the hafnium now linked to the new molecule, it's not regenerating the surface, so that you can't just detach that molecule and make another molecule of oxamide. You've unfortunately used up the surface at the moment.
Yes, so absolutely. I mean, at the moment, it's not a catalytic process. It's a stoichiometric process, so you need as many hafnium atoms as you have nitrogen molecules. That's a fairly big disadvantage, but you've got to start somewhere, and there's always a possibility of developing it into a catalytic process.
It's still amazing to think that people have only just discovered this chemical reaction, isn't it?
Well, yes. I mean, previously we've relied on the Haber process, which has been around since the 19th century, for combining nitrogen with hydrogen to make ammonia, and then from ammonia make all sorts of organonitrogen compounds and fertilisers and whatever. But if we could take it down to sort of room temperature and not needing all of these high pressures, that would be amazing.
Phil Broadwith, if you owned what could possibly be a priceless relic, it's unlikely you'd want researchers chipping bits off of it to try to understand its origins or to confirm its authenticity. Thankfully, newer techniques can do all of that, though, non-invasively.
My name is Marco Leona, and I'm the scientist in charge of the Department of Scientific Research at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. In our work, which has to do with the study of works of art and cultural heritage in general, we try to answer the basic question of what is this, what is it made of, and if the way we're looking at them now is exactly the way they were seen by people back when they were created.
And of course, by definition, if they're works of art, you don't want to damage them in the process.
That is a very significant component. We really need to respect them in every possible way. We cannot change any of their attributes. We must preserve them for people who will come after us, both to enjoy them and study them.
And if you damage them, they'll come after you for other reasons. But how do you propose to get around that problem of not physically damaging an object whilst at the same time interrogating it to find out its history?
Well, for instance, of general use in our field is X-ray fluorescence spectroscopy, where you use X-ray beams to probe the elemental composition of an object. By hitting an object with X-ray beams of a particular energy, you stimulate the production of secondary X-ray beams that are given off by the object, and their energies of these secondary X-ray beams is a measure of the composition. So without doing anything to the object, really, you can conduct elemental analysis in a completely non-invasive way.
But then again, if this is a fresco or something that's a work of art in situ, it's not terribly easy, or is it, to deploy an X-ray machine at it in order to do that?
A nice side, if you want, of all of the money that gets put into defense and anti-terrorism research is that techniques for first responders have been developed that are actually quite portable. So we have even battery-powered spectrometers for these used. So we could go on a scaffold or on an archaeological dig.
And what about Raman spectroscopy? Because I've talked to a number of people who have looked at paintings using this technique, and they say that this is probably one of the gold standard techniques for interrogating old works.
Raman spectroscopy is one of the greatest new tools that we have because we get information at the molecular level. We not only get the information that titanium or lead in an object, we know what atoms are bound to it so that we get a sense of what kind of crystalline compound, what kind of mineral, what kind of molecule is there. It is non-invasive because it works by shining a laser on the object, so as long as you have a good control over the energy level, you will not burn the sample, and it can be very specific.
So where X-rays are very useful for seeing the big heavy stuff, the metal atoms and so on, Raman spectroscopy can tell you about everything, including the metal, but the other things that are there as well, so it's potentially giving you a whole new dimension, I presume.
Exactly. It's very useful not only for identifying materials present, but for really studying their deterioration, understanding the form in which they are.
Are there any shortfalls with it, though?
Well, one of the things that, one of the problems with Raman spectroscopy is that the Raman effect is very weak. It works best for crystalline materials. It doesn't work that well for more loosely arranged structures. For instance, the linseed oil films that keep paintings together. Also, it suffers from fluorescence. When a substance is hit with laser light, even things that we don't consider fluorescent will possibly emit a lot of broadband light that tends to obscure every detail in the Raman spectrum.
And how can you get around that?
Well, we've been working a lot on surface-enhanced Raman scattering, which is a particular effect that takes place when organic molecules are adsorbed on the surface of metallic nanoparticles and nanostructures. This is a complex phenomenon that has to do with the interaction between the molecule's electronic structure and the surface electron wave of the metallic nanoparticles.
But nonetheless, you're still having to add something to the surface, aren't you? So is there a risk of changing the surface by doing this?
Well, unfortunately, in this case, we have to remove microscopic samples from the work so that we can do this type of analysis. The alternative, though, is using other techniques that would require samples at least 100 times larger.
And can you give us any contemporary examples of problems or puzzles that you've solved, or how you've unlocked our understanding of what went on in the past using precisely this approach?
Well, an interesting thing, as soon as we developed a method that allowed us to look at the very smallest sample, we're talking about 50 to 25 microns, so smaller than the diameter of a human hair, we were able to test a number of objects, and we started looking at medieval French sculpture. We have a few very important pieces from the 12th century, and pieces that had been thought to be from the same workshop based on stylistic reasons. We also found the same dye used on them, a dye that had to be imported from India. We have information from customs receipt that this dye, called lac dye, was imported in Marseille, France, in the late 13th century. And that is the earliest record of it in Europe. But in these two statues that come from near Marseille, actually, we find it a few decades earlier than that. So we have another link based on a workshop signature, the materials they were using. So these statues were both using the same dye, which would have been rare, which would have been imported by Muslim traders from North Africa. And the proximity to Marseille, the port of arrival, adds another element to their origin in a joint workshop. It's also very interesting to see that there was this level of trade connecting medieval France to India.
And these days we've replaced black dye with IT support and mass manufacturing. That was the Metropolitan Museum of Art scientist Marco Leona discussing how science is helping to unlock the history of ancient artifacts.
Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
This is Chemistry World with me, Chris Smith, and in a moment, from failed antidepressant to antidote to libido loss. That's how some people are dubbing one side effect of a drug that could soon be hitting the market. But first, Nina, arsenic.
So there's really tiny amounts of arsenic in all of our water, but in parts of Bangladesh and India, the levels can be well above the recommended levels. So once we know that arsenic is present in water, it's really easy to remove it, but the current field tests looking for it are really complex and quite slow. So this team, led by Parash Ray at Jackson State University in the US, have been looking at a better way to work out whether we've got arsenic in our drinking water, and they've developed a simple colour change method.
How does it work?
The method's based on gold nanoparticles, which are modified by attaching large organic ligands like the amino acid cysteine to their surface, and the nanoparticles are added to the water. And the arsenic also binds to the ligands, so if there's arsenic present, it causes the nanoparticles to clump together. So the more arsenic there is, the more and the larger the clumps are, and this affects the colour of the solution.
It's a bit like a pregnancy test, which works sort of similarly, but a bit different outcomes. Is this just a theoretical thing, or is this actually being deployed in the field now?
At the moment, it's still being tested, so they've got a number of more rigorous tests to carry out before they can actually take it out there and sell it to people.
But obviously a very major problem, because countries like you mentioned, India, Bangladesh, they have lots and lots of arsenic coming up from soil water and from mining and things like that, and it is a big problem. So something like this could presumably make a huge difference, as long as the people can get hold of the purification kits.
Yeah, presumably it really should, because it is, as you said, a really major problem.
Thank you, Nina. Right, OK. Well, from arsenic in your drinking water to putting lead in your pencil, how about that, Matt? Tell us about this.
Well, there's a new drug that could give a boost to the sex drive of women that are suffering from low libido. Basically, Boehringer Ingelheim developed an antidepressant drug called Filbanserin, and it failed quite spectacularly in clinical trials, not showing it wasn't very efficacious. But one of the problems with these drugs is that often they actually reduce sex drive in women. So this is one of the common side effects that will be tested in clinical trials. And those early clinical trials for the antidepressant indication actually showed that it boosted sex drive in some women. So now they've been developing it as a treatment for women with hypoactive sexual desire disorder, which basically means that they have no desire at all for sex.
Is this a real disorder, though? Because if these people are depressed, they're not going to feel like having sex anyway. So do you think it's just a side effect of depression and this really is a real manifestation?
Well, there are many a claim of pharmaceutical companies developing diseases that they can sell drugs into. But certainly some experts, including Kathleen Seagraves at Case Western Reserve University in the US, believes that HSDD, as it's known, is a very real disorder, and the potential of treatment for these women is very exciting. Basically, she says that the low desire is not related to depression, and except for the relationship bond with their partner, the woman would be okay if she never had sex at all. Apparently, many women describe the loss of desire as, I want to have sex.
Do we actually know how this agent works then, the fact that it's having this sexual side effect?
Well, it works as a 5-HT1A receptor agonist and a 5-HT2A receptor antagonist, which are both serotonin receptors. And it also acts as a partial agonist at the dopamine D4 receptor. Now, all of these receptors play a part in depression, happiness, and apparently also in sexual desire.
Why just women, though? Do we think that it's just a side effect of the fact the trial was only done in women in which this question is asked, or was it involving both sexes and it was just the women that reported this particular side effect?
Well, I think that the results from these four phase three trials is obviously that they've designed the trial as a potential treatment for women suffering from this problem, and I don't think that there are many men suffering from that sort of problem. The problems that men have generally been solved by drugs such as Viagra and Cialis that work in a different way altogether, not usually involving a lack of desire.
And is this stuff on the market, or is this just at the clinical trial stage and they're saying they might take this further, or have they now got approval for it?
Well, it's in between clinical trials stage and approval. They've finished four pivotal phase three clinical trials, all of which seem to have very positive results. So at the moment, I believe Boehringer Ingelheim are gathering the data together and preparing to submit the data to the US Food and Drug Administration and the other regulatory authorities around the world to ask for approval for the drug.
I suspect men everywhere will be pricking up their ears over that story. Thank you, Matt. Well, that's pretty much it for this month. But before we go, we have to catch up with the answer to the chemical conundrum from last time. So please, Phil, remind us of the question.
Well, last month we asked you what analytical technique was being used by scientists to prove or disprove the existence of water on the moon.
And the answer is infrared spectroscopy. Scientists have been using this to detect oxygen-hydrogen bonds in hydroxyl and water groups, both present in the surface of the moon and gases formed when they've bombarded the moon with large chunks of rock.
So it's not slam a massive rocket into the bottom end of the moonoscopy, then?
Indeed, no.
But they did have some success, because they reckon that there's something like 1 litre of water in every about 17 tonnes of moon rock, so it's relatively abundant, you could say. What do you want to know next month?
OK, so with it being all wintry at the moment, we're going to ask what chemical compound is used in car engine coolant systems and windscreen washing fluid to prevent it from freezing over the winter.
I wish I'd had some of that in my car over the weekend. I couldn't wash my windscreen all the way down the motorway. I had arrived with a rather unkempt hairstyle with having my head out of the driver's window all the way down the motorway. What do people have to do to enter, and what are they going to win?
Well, they're going to win a goodie bag, including the RSC book, Kitchen Chemistry, and a glow-in-the-dark RSC pen. And all you have to do to enter is send your name and address to chemistryworld@rsc.org.
And it would probably be a very good idea to include the answer too. Thank you, Matt. Well, that's it for this episode, but do bear in mind, before we return next month, you can keep yourself amused and entertained, at least chemically speaking, by tuning into our sister podcast, Chemistry in Its Element, where each week we take a look at the sinister side of the elements that make up the periodic table. Contributors this month were Matt Wilkinson, Phil Broadwith, and Nina Notman, and I'm Chris Smith from thenakedscientist.com. Happy New Year, and until next time, goodbye.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.